7:59. Stay tuned for Positively Revolting right after this.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Other September 11th, film screening and discussion about the lasting impacts of the U.S.-funded military coup in Chile on September 11th, 1973. The event will take place on Friday, September 11th at 7 p.m. at the Fifth Avenue Cinema in Portland. This film screening will include two 30-minute documentaries that focus on Mapuche land reclamation and language revitalization, as well as a discussion with the filmmaker about the specific laws that have been used to target the indigenous Mapuche people since the dictatorship began in 1973. Again, that's The Other September 11th on Friday, September 11th at 7 p.m. at Fifth Avenue Cinema, 510 Southwest Hall Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Who is Gil Scott-Heron as part of the We Real Cool Jazz Series at the Clinton Street Theater Thursday, September 17th at 7 p.m. Who is Gil Scott-Heron is a portrait seen through the eyes of those who love Gil, his friends, his family, and the musicians he played with. All attending the theatrical screenings receive a download of Scott-Heron's last record, Nothing New. Again, that's Who is Gil Scott-Heron, Thursday, September 17th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Rockets and moonshots.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
Comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
And good morning, good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And this morning, we are talking about healthcare, and especially healthcare.
And so much more.
Healthcare as really a human right. And specifically, we'll be talking about Healthcare for All Oregon and a play that is coming up in a couple of weeks that is a benefit for Healthcare for All Oregon called Mercy Killers. And so helping us this morning, talking about this, starting off the show, is Peter Marr, Dr. Peter Marr. He is the president of the Portland chapter of Physicians for National Health Program. Thank you very much, Peter, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And by phone, we will be having the actor in
the
Mercy
actor,
Killers.
The writer, the recipient of a Scotsman's Fringe Award.
That one-man show sort of fellow.
And he got, which is, I love the Fringe event in Edinburgh. In 2013, he won the Scotsman Fringe First Award for this. They people are calling this, the Daily Beast called Mercy Killers, the play that we're going to talk about, the play Obamacare needs. Though I do like to call it the Affordable Health Act, but that's just me. Among other things, it is, they talk about it being kind of a, Michael Milligan is a, the kind of is in the tradition of Arthur Miller, Clifford Odets, Tony Kushner, Anna DeVere Smith in capturing political and social reality in a powerful story and an unforgettable character. Those are pretty big words. Those are, that sounds rather amazing because Michael has been around the theater biz for about 20 years. He has done, I could list his names, but then we won't have the rest of the show. We won't have anything else. So he may be on the line with us right now. Michael? Oh, okay. Well, in the meantime, we'll talk with Peter. Yes.
Right. So, good morning, Peter.
Good morning again.
It is one of those sort of wild and woolly mornings here at KBOO, your community radio station. Thank you so much for joining us again here on Positively Revolting. Let's start back up for a moment. You're the president of the Portland Chapter of Physicians for National Healthcare. What is that about? What is Physicians for National Health Program?
Well, Physicians for National Health Program, or commonly known as PNHP, is a national organization based in Chicago, started 20 to 25 years ago, maybe more, by several physicians out of Harvard. And as its name implies, these physicians are in favor of a national health insurance program, which would provide universal coverage for everyone in the country through what is commonly known as a single-payer mechanism, where all premiums that are paid currently by employers and individuals are instead paid into one single government payer, which then pays hospitals and physicians for their services. This would dramatically reduce administrative costs and would dramatically increase the efficiency of our healthcare system.
Well, wait. What would the insurance companies do?
In our plan, there would be no insurance companies.
What?
I love this plan. Tell me more.
What?
By the elimination of the insurance companies, well, it seems like that would take a lot of cost out of the program.
Yes, it's estimated that now about one in every three healthcare dollars is wasted to administrative costs, much of which goes to the process of using health insurance companies as middlemen. There is a significant amount of profit in the health insurance industry. In fact, Aetna, which is the insurer for many people in the area, specifically for Portland State students, the CEO of Aetna made $45 million last year. So there's a significant amount of cost with specifically just going to insurance companies. But what costs the system more is the fact that insurance companies sell multiple products, and insurance companies often try to deny claims or not pay, which then on the other side of the coin, the hospital and physician level, means that hospitals and physicians have to hire people to deal with the insurance companies. And the back and forth battle of payment and non-payment creates a level of bureaucracy that no other healthcare system in the world has to deal with. And that's where you get this one in three healthcare dollars going to administrative costs.
Well, and also, don't the insurance companies kind of butt in, as a physician, butt in on your expertise and your ability to prescribe for your patients?
There is a significant amount of denials and awaiting decisions on whether MRIs or other costly referrals are covered or not. Yes, there is a fair amount of that as well, which is hard to deal with.
Yeah, I've heard some activists refer to the insurance industry as the healthcare denial industry or the healthcare denial business.
Yes, and that's interesting that you brought that up, because in many other countries, they use something called health insurance funds. In fact, in France, which is, I'm not sure last year, but I think the most recent rating of the World Health Organization ranked France as the number one healthcare system in the world, uses health insurance funds, they call them. But this is a completely different entity from our profit or even nonprofit health insurance companies here in the United States. In these systems around the world that use these health insurance funds as the middlemen, they don't allow for-profit financing. If a health insurance fund in France makes money one year, their profit is turned over to another health insurance fund who didn't make any money. And there's several other important regulations on them, including they have to pay the claim immediately with no matter what. They can only deny or try to appeal a claim later. And they are, we already talked about the profit issue, and they also have an efficiency issue. They are not allowed to spend more than 5% on administrative costs. So all of these regulations ensure that basically they're acting as a payment mechanism, focusing on service and efficiency. Whereas our health insurance companies really make money by denying care and trying to avoid paying for sick people.
That's just so crazy. I'm sorry. It always completely knocks me over when someone makes that statement, because it's true.
Yes. So it's an unfortunate situation that we're in right now, because when we adopted the newest healthcare law, the Affordable Care Act, we did not go back to the fundamentals of what would make a health insurance program or a health care system work here in the United States. We never went back to that argument. We just assumed that the system we had was the infrastructure we were going to go forward with and try to make some improvements on that going forward.
But didn't the insurance companies write a lot of it?
And part of the reason for that was that the medical industrial complex was involved in the manufacturing of this law, heavily involved. And so what I like to do, especially from the perspective of Physicians for National Health Program, is go back and look at what would make a health care or a health insurance coverage system effective. And you don't have to look far. You can look at any other country, wealthy country in the world that has a universal healthcare system, provides it with about half the cost that we do, and has great outcomes. Or you can look at the Institute of Medicine, who published a 224-page report in 2004, it's called Insuring America's Health, Principles and Recommendations. And you look at those principles, and there are five of them. They're very simple. Healthcare coverage should be universal. Healthcare coverage should be continuous. Healthcare coverage should be affordable and individual to families. Affordable to individuals and families. Health insurance strategy should be affordable and sustainable for society. And fifth, health insurance should enhance health and well-being by promoting access to high-quality care that is effective, efficient, safe, timely, patient-centered, and equitable. That all sounds great, and unfortunately, our current health insurance program does not hit any of those, does not cover any of those principles fully.
Hey, I want to talk about this more, but we've got Michael Milligan on the line. We gave you this amazing introduction, and you weren't here to hear it, Michael. But trust me.
We have sung your praises.
We have sung your praises up one. Okay, do it again. He's an actor, for heaven's sakes.
No, that's all right.
Okay. Thank you for writing this amazing play, Mercy Killers. What made you want to do this, such a grueling thing as this one? First of all, one-man shows are, though it seems that you've done quite a few, are pretty taxing on your energy and what. So what gave you the drive to do this? What made you want to do the Mercy Killers?
Well, Before I've been doing this show for the last 3 years, and before that I was pursuing a more of a regular, whatever that means in terms of the life of an actor, but kind of a normal career, doing a lot of regional theater, a lot of Shakespeare, did some shows on Broadway. But I had a number of experiences that really led me to see how artists as a demographic in our society are greatly marginalized by the healthcare system and have been because of the nature of you know, an artist's labors being often self-employed, going through periods of unemployment. And the first thing that happened was I was in a relationship with someone who had a lot of healthcare needs, and it gradually consumed our finances, and also gave me a sort of inside look into what it is like to be the partner of someone who is struggling to finance their health needs, and that all sort of coincided with the Occupy Wall Street movement, which at that time I was living in New York City, so I just happened to walk down to Zuccotti Park, and I saw all these other people down there who were going through similar situations in the wake of the financial crisis, and it just made me realize the extent to which the previous years my partner and I had just been treading water. And it made me think of the healthcare system, and I don't use this term lightly, but that what we have is had going on is something that I call a medical holocaust. And I use that word, I understand the implication. And the reason I use that word is if you add up the number of people who die every year for lack of access to healthcare for conditions that are amenable to healthcare, and you add up those numbers over the course of the years, you start to get a picture of the huge catastrophe. And the other reason I use that word is that it's like a silent holocaust, yeah? Because when something happens to a couple or to a person, they oftentimes withdraw because of the feelings of shame and humiliation and anger. And there are so many feelings that can't be communicated, or we feel that we can't communicate. And it's a tragic situation because it's exactly at that moment that we need to reach out, because the problems that we're facing, actually we have to come together as a community to face the problem. So that was one of the experiences that led me to get involved with the healthcare justice movement, and then started to get my wheels rolling about how I could make a contribution.
One of the things your character talks about, and I've watched a little bit of this on because of the miracle of the internet, that people don't think about, and I'm really glad you brought it up, is he's talking about that he needs surgery. The surgery will be paid for, but he's just got a new business. And what's he going to do?
Yeah.
Part is not dealt with ever at all. People think if your health care is, that should be part of the health care, is also the person's whole life.
Well, and I think also it spills over into other areas. It's not just about healthcare. In the play, my character is an auto mechanic from southeastern Ohio, and he's kind of has a red state mentality. He's a little bit of has sort of Tea Party leaning. So his wife gets cancer, and he's in a situation where he's done everything right, but in spite of all of his best efforts, they still find themselves in a situation where they can't pay for her care. But like you said, he's just started a new business. And I think this is a huge thing that is often overlooked, is the life decisions that people make in our country purely based on keeping their health insurance, either for themselves or for their partner, either because they have a chronic disease or, you know, for many other reasons. But it seems to me profoundly un-American that we're supposed to be the, you know, the country of liberty and of, you know, entrepreneurs and people going out and doing their own thing, and tying your access to healthcare, making it contingent on, you know, having a particular employer or, you know, staying at this particular job. It seems like a huge barrier to people, you know, fulfilling their deepest dreams and callings and starting new businesses and et cetera.
I heard a radio story about when the Affordable Health Care Act first started, and there were some right-wing senators that were, they thought that people weren't going to keep being employed full-time if this thing happened, because it was, one woman said, wow, I can finally work part-time now with this. Now, I don't think the Affordable Health Care Act is near what we need, but she was actually able to work part-time instead of full-time, and they somehow felt that was somehow un-American to not work 60 hours a week. I don't know. I mean, in Holland, in the Netherlands, almost everyone works part-time because, you know, healthcare isn't the issue, and they find that they get better productivity of people, and people are now, don't tell anyone, they're happier. And we, as a culture, don't seem to be much for that these days.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great point. That's a really great point, too, yeah.
Well, thank you. So let's get Peter and Michael talking about. So what? How did the play and the Physicians for Healthcare All Oregon and how did you guys get together?
Well, I do want to mention that which we neglected to do at first, that at this point it does not look like a national health insurance strategy is coming forth, and at least in the next few years. But there is an amendment to the Affordable Care Act, which allows states to implement their own health care system from 2017 onwards, as long as it's at least as good as the Affordable Care Act. And this amendment was sponsored by Ron Wyden, our senator. So we're very excited here in the state of Oregon and other states like Colorado, Hawaii, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, New York, to look at creating a universal healthcare system, a real universal healthcare system here in Oregon. And there's an organization that has started called Healthcare for All Oregon, HCAO or HCAO.org. Which is gaining traction by the minute. And we are the organization, Healthcare for All Oregon, in Oregon, that is striving to implement such a system here in the state. And it was Healthcare for All Oregon that got in touch with Michael and his production, Mercy Killers, and arranged for it to be shown here in the state. And so that's how this connection happened, and we're very excited that it's finally coming up very, very, very.
And it's going
close.
To be Thursday, September 17th from 8 to 10 at the Alberta Rose Theater, which is a great venue. Michael, you're going to really like it. 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. And you can easily contact the Alberta Rose Theater for tickets for that.
There's actually a couple of things. I think tickettomato.com is actually
the
site to
get
advance tickets.
So it is.
You can get tickets at the door. Also, September 19th for folks that live a little south of Portland.
Right.
The
in
Lynn Corvallis. Benton Community College Russell Tripp Auditorium, which is kind of a mouthful. But the Lynn Benton Community College Russell Tripp Auditorium will also be hosting this play on September 19th. So September 17th in Portland, September 19th in Corvallis.
And I believe there's also September 18th in Newport. September 20th in Springfield, September 24th in Florence, and September 25th in Eugene. So Michael really has
Michael's
going
to get a workout for him.
The state tour.
Yeah.
You're going to need a whole retinue of people to follow you around this morning. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. We are talking this morning with Michael Milligan, writer and actor in the one-man show called Mercy Killers, Dr. Peter Marr from the Physicians for... Oops, I forgot to write. There's so many groups here this morning. Okay, for the Portland Physicians for National Healthcare, the chapter of that and the health program. Later, we're going to be talking with Dr. Sam Metz, who is with the Mad as Hell Doctors. And you can contact us by, if you want to have questions or comments about healthcare, anything that we're discussing this morning, give us a call, 503-231-8187. You can also contact us on Gmail at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com, or the Facebook, Positively Revolting, or Twitter at Positive Revolt. These are all things that you may do.
Indeed. And 503-231-8187 is the number to call if you'd like to join us on air this morning. If you have questions about healthcare for all or about this play, then please do join us and call on in. You were talking about how there are, Dr. Peter Marr, you were talking about how there are so many principles that need to be engaged in adequate, or let's say be moving beyond adequate to good health coverage, and how we don't have any of those at this time. Can we get back to that for just a moment? I know.
Yeah, it's just unfortunate. The Affordable Care Act was never designed to be a universal system. We knew going in that 31 million people were to be left uninsured by 2023. That was a study by the Congressional Budget Office. And extrapolating from that, 337,000 Oregonians would be left uninsured. So we knew going in that it wouldn't meet that first principle of universality. The second principle we've touched on already with brief stories from Michael's production about continuity. They're arbitrary. Insurance status will change due to life circumstances, common life circumstances, getting married, getting divorced, getting hired, getting fired, turning 65, falling into poverty, falling out of poverty. All of these put you into a different risk pool or different category, and your insurance drops into that. And I see that every day in my practice. I'll be expecting to see someone back, and I notice that, they've transferred to Kaiser. Why? They probably got a job, or vice versa. They've been followed for Kaiser for 20 years, since they were 8 years old. They love their doctor, love the system. They show up in my clinic this month because they lost their job, or they are doing something else with their life, and now they're on our Oregon Health Plan, and they're in my clinic. And so this continuity of care is just disrupted by the actual infrastructure of the system. All these other systems around the world, people are guaranteed access to health care from birth to death, as it should be, regardless of any significant personal changes in their life. And we've discussed that a little bit already today, and I think in Michael's production, we'll see that a lot more. And then the affordability issue is just huge. Premiums are outstripping inflation and incomes every year.
And for less care for the most part, right?
And then we're talking about transferring of cost to patients. We always talk about skin in the game. Patients need to know what it costs. They need to pay their share. Well, in fact, skin in the game means that patients will not access care. If they can't afford the deductible, they won't get care. And we've had patients, for example, a young woman who had a breast lump, and there was a delay of 3 to 6 months of getting the biopsy done because of deductible costs. Mm-hmm. And in that 3 to 6 months, who knows what happens, but it did end up that she had a type of breast cancer that had spread. And this is a young woman. It got treated, she got a little better, but unfortunately later it came back, and she has ended up dying from her breast cancer. So is that 3 to 6 month delay important in that story? We don't know for sure, but it sure could be. And if it is, yeah, it's a disaster. And that's the type of thing that Michael's talking about. And I could go on, but one more point I wanted to make about the affordability is that the principles of affordability aren't just for individuals and families, they're for community and society as well. And if we're spending one-fifth of our GDP on healthcare, which is twice of what the average of other wealthy nations spend on healthcare, then what the significant thing about that is what we're not spending it on. If we're spending it on healthcare, we're not spending it on schools, we're not spending it on paid maternity leave, we're not spending it on public transportation, and we're not spending it on parks, and therefore the overall health, public health of the population decreases. So those are the kind of the points that are important and just how significant this issue is and how important having a real working universal healthcare system would be for this country.
Well put, Dr. Peter Maher.
Yeah. May I say something?
Please, chime on in.
Listening to Peter, I just wanted to share with you guys that I'm in the process of writing a new piece about the healthcare system that arose out of this touring that I've been doing. I often collaborate with doctors and nurses, and traveling around the country, I just started to notice and observe that our healthcare workers carry a very similar kind of burden around the country of frustration and anger with the system, and the new piece is about one particular doctor's experience in the healthcare system. And I think this is something that's often overlooked or that the general public don't really understand and get a sense of is the levels of burnout among doctors in our country are disturbing, and the added misery that we create in our system of using insurance creates unnecessary burden on doctors. So think about it. Mm-hmm. Number one, the frustration of seeing a patient and knowing that your diagnosis is not going to that you're not going to be able to prescribe what you want to prescribe based on what is the best practice, but you're going to have to make your decisions based on what an insurance company is going to allow, or if a person doesn't have insurance, having a person sit across from you knowing that there's something available and you can't do anything about it. How do you have that conversation with that person, and what does that do to you as a healer to have that conversation with people day in, day out, weeks, months, years?
Right.
And then also on top of that, you know, the play I'm doing is about a primary care physician in private practice. And as I've been trying to interview doctors, I've discovered that is something of a unicorn now, something that is almost entirely disappeared, where doctors now either work in a large physician group or they primary care practices are all bought up by hospitals. Because in order to, you know, if you're a doctor, you have to have three assistants just dealing with billing, hunting down insurance companies, and getting pre-authorizations. Have any of you ever dealt with that pre-authorization for a treatment or a medication?
Yes, and that's a common thing that we talked about briefly before, is that not only are you having a huge administrative burden in your office of people just receiving payment, just to get payment, but also you're dealing with restrictions. And the problem is that the restrictions vary from insurance company to insurance company. And then the other problem is we're dealing with thousands and thousands of different plans, different insurance companies, and different programs that people are in. Even in my office, where we mostly accept Medicaid and Medicare, We, in some of our offices, we hire 5 people to be eligibility representatives, so that they're just basically going over people's incomes and making sure that they qualify for Medicaid. Those are 5 people that we've hired in order to
job list. Creators. That's what you are
in a sense. But I think we could be more efficient.
We could probably find better jobs.
I know.
By reinvesting those wasted dollars into programs that actually help people and not just create layers of bureaucracy between patients and physicians. We want to thank Peter for joining us, Dr. Peter Marr. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. We understand you must run off now.
Yes. It's been a pleasure, and hopefully my colleague Dr. Sam Metz will take my place.
Yes, we're being joined by Dr.
Thank you so much.
Samuel
Thank
Metz,
you.
Also for the Oregon chapter of Physicians for a National Healthcare Program. You were in Mad as Hell Doctors too, huh?
Correct. Peter and I are members of this.
We need your microphone on
for it to work.
We call it the yellow mic, and our engineering pixie is currently growing extra arms, I think, trying to deal with the exegesis and entrances and phone calls and things. Let's try this now. Good morning.
Dr. Matt.
Hi.
Thank you very much. I've had...
Here, we're just going to actually throw the red mic in front of you. We know it works.
Thank you very much.
No.
One more time from the top.
Well, let's work pick and yellow.
All right. Now with us this morning.
We're picking the yellow mic for the good Dr. Samuel Metz this morning. Okay.
I'm delighted to be here.
Here he is. All right. Yay.
I've had 13 years of higher education, and I can't figure out how to turn on a microphone. I'm pleased we've got such expert help.
It is a good thing.
It is a lovely thing.
And so Mad as Hell Doctors, how did you get involved with Mad as Hell Doctors? What was your inspiration to become sort of an activist physician?
Very much like Peter, seeing that the American healthcare system was grinding people up. Probably the biggest motivator for me was realizing that the stories that Peter shared, that I'm seeing, that Michael is illustrating, are uniquely American. This only happens in America. The story that Michael tells in his play you can't see that in any other developed country where you can drink the water. France, Germany, the number of medical bankruptcies, and I think Michael might have even given you a number, about 700,000 every year in the United States. It's pretty impressive. That's about 2,000 people every day who are bankrupted because they've got a treatable condition, but they don't have the money for it. The number of medical bankruptcies in Europe, in the Pacific Rim countries, Australia, New Zealand, total almost zero. This is a uniquely American disease, medical bankruptcy.
I was thinking of, and in Mexico, you can't always drink the water, but you can get health care.
Take your choice.
Yeah, right.
So, so many places to go from here. I want to remind people you are listening to KABU, your community radio station. This is Positively Revolting, that show that talks about, revolting in a positive manner. And we can take your call at 503-231-8187. You can also follow along on Facebook. You can like our page, Positively Revolting. You can get us in the Twitterverse at Positive Revolt, and or you can email us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. But let us hear from you at 503-231-8187. We have callers that are leaving questions but not sticking around. So we have a question from someone who asks, do we actually have a health care with care for cancer, heart disease, and general health, or is it just a system made for corporations to sell us chemotherapy drugs?
In fact, the United States healthcare, once you get it, is pretty good. If you compare the results of people who get treatment in the United States to people who get treatment in other developed countries, we're not bad. The challenge is that there are so many tens of millions of people in the United States who can't get in the front door of a clinic or a hospital. In other developed countries, that is not a problem. Nobody is denied care because they don't have money in other developed countries. We have that problem.
So the affordable health care didn't fix all that. We've been sort of talking about that this morning. You haven't gotten in that conversation yet, so I'll let you do that, Dr. Meth.
Very good. It might relate to what I heard Michael talking about for one of his next projects. If we're going to try to achieve better care to more people for less money, which is pretty much the goal of healthcare reform, we can either take one of three routes. We can either keep doing what we're doing now more intensely, that's the Affordable Care Act, and hope for something different. We can either try things that have never been tried before in healthcare before and hope that they work, like vouchers. Or we can look at systems that already provide better care to more people for less money and see what they're doing that we're not. The one characteristic that successful systems possess that we don't have now and the Affordable Care Act doesn't create is universal access. We should not mistake insurance for access.
Yeah, what does universal access really mean?
It means that a person who wants medical care can seek it and get it no matter how much money they have or don't have. Right now, we have rationed health care based on how much money you have. That's not the case in other developed countries. In a country with access, I know that my family will get health care that they need when they need it, no matter what happens to me, no matter how hired, fired, retired, or expired I become, my family still has that access. And that is true in every other developed country. Once you're in Europe, once you're in Pacific Rim countries, Oceania, your family will get health care no matter what happens to you tonight or tomorrow. That's what access is all about. In the United States, you still need money for access.
And a whole lot of money, it seems. Those costs are increasing every year. I have healthcare coverage, and I work in a small nonprofit. We call it KABU. And every year we look at that cost increasing, which is a huge burden, you know, for the employer. It's also a big burden for the subscriber, the patient, as we look at, do we increase our deductibles to be able to afford anything? Do we, you know, what are the factors in the mix? And it never really looks positive for the person actually trying to access the system.
On Michael's website, he does make the point that of the 700,000 medical bankruptcies that occur every year in the United States, most of these occurred in families that had insurance at the time the medical crisis began. Most debt in the United States is medical debt. If you're being called by a collection agency, it's a greater 50% chance that you got sick and that's why you're being called. Having an insurance policy does not guarantee access. Remember, if you've got a deductible or a copay, if you don't have any money for that, you still have no access. It doesn't protect you against bankruptcy. Remember, most medical bankruptcies occur in families that have medical insurance. Now, that is the tragedy. And again, this is something that's illustrated in Michael's play, is that we think this is normal. We think that this is the way it should be. If you can't afford health care for your family, then that's just the way we should have it. You don't get the flat screen television you want. You don't get the new care you want. You don't get the treatment, the hospital you want. We lump health care into that commodity, and we say, if you're going to get health care, you have to deserve it.
So are you saying this is a human right?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough one, because there's all sorts of disputes about human rights, but very few people would argue against a system that provides better care to more people for less money. And that's the advantage of universal care. It's not just that all of the universal care systems we know provide better care for less money. It's that it assures everyone who participates that they don't have to worry about whether their family is going to get access. It's not a pay-as-you-go. You prepay your health care, just like you prepay for police protection, and there you go.
I want to let folks know we have Jeremy on the line. Good morning, Jeremy. Welcome to Positively Revolting.
Yeah, I you know, don't in any significant way disagree with anything you said. And I haven't heard the whole show, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there's some difference of opinion as to the quality of U.S. health outcomes, regardless of access. Something I've heard commonly is that we, you know, pay twice as much as France and do worse. And we don't just do worse if you're poor. I think we do worse if you're middle class also. You know, all those people with some insurance going broke, some of them aren't all that poor. And they're still going broke because of bankruptcy laws and the general lack of any, you know, moral interest in social justice here. Because, you know, anyway.
Okay.
And one other thing, I wanted to offer an anecdote. A friend of mine who makes, you know, less than 40 grand a year, I think his employer is paying 12, 14, 15 for his health insurance. He has non-pressure glaucoma, which could cause him to go blind. And there's an acupuncture protocol, which is, of course, not covered by his insurance. That is less likely to occur in France or any of the other civilized countries. You know, access to acupuncture or homeopathy, things with, you know, hundreds of years of proven results are denied because, you know, healthcare in this country is structured to make and keep doctors, insurance companies, and investors rich.
And all right.
All that occurs in Europe, too. Just not quite as obnoxious. Anyway,
all right, thanks, Jeremy. I also want to caution folks to not use the word civilized when you mean developed, because there's a whole lot of developing and non-developed nations.
As usual, your sensitivity to anyone's sarcasm is lacking.
Okay, well, there you go.
I'd like to corroborate
Jeremy's
observation. Not only is American health care the most expensive in the world, twice as high as the average, and our health care outcomes the worst in the developed world. That's true no matter what class you're in. If you compare the poor in the U.S. to the poor in other countries, we look worse in terms of how much we spend and our results. But that's also true for the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
It's also true for the rich and employed. Not only is this a low-value system if you're poor and sick, it's a low-value system if you're rich and healthy as well. It is a system that offers very little value for anyone who needs health care.
All right. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You are listening to KABU. This is Positively Revolting. We're talking about health care and access to it. We're talking about health care for Oregon, and we're talking about a benefit coming up that's a one-man play called Mercy Killers. We do have Michael Mulligan on the line. He is the playwright and actor for Mercy Killers. Michael, I want to just go back to the play for a moment. And, you know, I think it's a really wonderful tact that you're coming at it from the perspective your character is coming at it as somebody who might not have really believed in universal health care until suddenly you saw the need for it. An old co-host of mine, who is now passed on, used to say, reality is when it happens to you.
Hmm.
And I think that as an illustrating tool, that's a wonderful framing for the play. Can you talk a little bit more about your ideas there?
Well, the character Joe is a redneck,
and I'm allowed to use that word because I come from a long line of rednecks in Ohio, and I've had a lot of very interesting experiences. I do a lot of touring. All the places I'm going in Oregon look like beautiful venues, but I've done stuff like I toured around rural West Virginia, rural Colorado. I just came back from Texas, and a lot of times I get people in the audience who aren't theater goers, and definitely are not people who would fall into the political party of universal health care. But we always have talkbacks after the show, and they're really incredible. And my conclusion from those talkbacks is that people, when it comes to health care, their opinions and their experiences don't fit into the carefully sort of crafted political camps that people would like us to fit into. For example, I was just down in Texas, and I stopped and got my hair cut at this guy. His barber shop was set up in a Latino grocery, and it was called Straight Razor Steve. Yeah.
Oh, how could you not go there?
Yeah. In the window, he had a jar. It said Obamacare Penalty Fund. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, I got to go in there and see what this guy has to say. So I go in there, I sit down, and he's cutting my hair, and I say, oh, so tell me about that jar. And he says, look, I couldn't afford health insurance before the Affordable Care Act, and now after the Affordable Care Act, if I buy health insurance, then I won't be able to afford health care, because I can only afford this high deductible plan. So he basically goes to a community clinic where they have a sliding scale and he pays cash. But, I said to him, hey, what's the solution? And he's cutting my hair. He goes, I don't know. And I have to say, he's a pretty conservative guy. Yeah. But he says, I don't know. But I don't think government has the solution, right? So there's a silence, and he's cutting my hair a little bit longer. And then he says, but did you ever see that that Michael Moore movie?
I was thinking about that.
Yeah, yeah. He goes, I thought it was kind of interesting when they went down to Cuba, how they did things down in Cuba. He said, maybe something like that could work here.
But no government.
So I'm sitting there thinking, oh, my God. So anyway, I invited him. I said, I do this play. Da, da, da. I invited him to the show. He came to the show with his wife. They stayed in the lobby, and his wife, after the show, was like, oh, my God, we loved it. He loved it. She's talking to him for him because he can't speak. He was so moved by the show. And then they left, and he wrote me this beautiful email afterwards about, being the voice of the voiceless and the power of this piece and what it meant to him. And it was very moving to me, because before I started doing the show, I would have pigeonholed him, based on the way he may have voted or something like that. But he connected deeply to the piece and his specific frustrations with the healthcare system from his perspective were justified,
Sure.
And by listening to him and actually sharing with him, we came to a real common understanding of things. And I think that this is true across the country. There are people who basically, as soon as we start talking about anything political, we start using trigger words, and someone uses a word, and then all of a sudden it triggers a bunch of bullet points from us that trigger a bunch of bullet points from the other person.
Right.
And we stop talking about real things. We stop being individual human beings, and we start being, parrots of political talking points, basically. And oftentimes when you get under those points, you find out, you know, I remember another conversation with a guy where basically he was a conservative guy who invented for me in the moment a single payer system, but would never call it that.
Michael has an interesting point about the collision between preconceived notions and harsh reality. They say that a Democrat is a Republican who's been mugged, and a Republican is a Democrat who's been arrested. Yeah, the people who are most opposed to any health care reform are people who have never had a major medical crisis in their family. Once that ship runs into the iceberg of your family's in danger, you're taking on water, and who's there to help you? Mm-hmm. Views change. And I think that's the value of Mercy Killers, is that it illustrates how difficult that is for some people who, like this barber, who have lived their whole life thinking that the problem is the government. And then there's the reality of somebody's sick, where's the access, and how can we create a system that will do that? Sometimes we have to shed a lot of favorite philosophies to get better care to more people for less money.
Well, you know, I would say in his particular case, his complaint, he was calling it government. But then when that was unpacked, his real complaint was crony capitalism. And so his complaint about Obamacare was the same as actually my complaint about Obamacare, which is, you know, the fortifying of these private industries, these private insurance companies.
Yeah.
And so, you know, after saying government doesn't have the solution, for him to jump to Cuba, obviously he does. You know, obviously there is room for government to do something in his mind, but his idea of government is basically
shaped by Fox News. Shall we just say that's been the elephant in the room here? It's shaped by Fox News and their talking points that hammer on to people continually.
It's interesting
also he lives in Texas, and the politics there are corrupt in a certain way.
Sure.
And so his experience of this is another thing that I learned down there that, you know, I hope people in Oregon understand is that Obamacare really doesn't work in Texas because they refuse the Medicaid expansion.
Right.
And that has really, really, you know, it's a self-inflicted wound, but all the people who are below the level of qualifying for subsidies, they don't get anything. And to qualify for Medicaid anyway in Texas, you can look it up, but it's something
right.
like you have to make less than $3,000 a year and have children or something like that. I mean, it's
right.
really,
it's
really different.
The bar is high.
Draconian, some folks would say.
We really need to wrap up, Michael. We just have about a minute and a half left here. I need to let people know that coming up at 9 this morning on KABU, Roberta Hall's guests are Leah Bulger and Bart Bulger, who founded the Linus Pauling chapter of Vets for Peace. They'll be discussing an ad campaign to publicize the importance of the recently achieved Iran nuclear deal. At 9:30, the topic is digital ageism with Canadian professor Kim Sawchurch, who is currently researching aging and mobile technology and ways to bridge the age divide in communities. 10 o'clock, we'll be hearing Flashpoints, U.S.-backed counterinsurgency forces in the Philippines, murder three key leaders and educators from the radical opposition. Also, a report from Nepal, still devastated from massive earthquakes that rocked the country earlier this year. At 11, Intersections Radio looks at underrepresented voices from minorities in India. And at 11:30, Radio Zine host Don Merrill interviews legendary mystery author Sue Grafton about her newest book, X. We thank KABU members for supporting us. Remember, you are how we stay on the air. Please do support us today. If you are not currently a KABU member, you can do so by going to our website, kboo.fm. While you're at our website, donating. You can also find out more information about Mercy Killers, as KBOO is a co-sponsor of this play, and you can look on the right-hand side of our homepage, kboo.fm, down there under Community Events. September 17th is when the play is happening, and you can get more information about it, including where to get your tickets and all of that kind of information right there. We have just a minute left. I want to thank both of you, Dr. Sam Metz and Michael Mulligan, for joining us this morning. I think this play is a brilliant piece, because really fiction, novels, plays, poetry, they reach people in ways that polemics and talking points don't. And so thank you so much for producing this play, Michael, and we look forward to it.
Thank you so much for having me on and supporting.
Excellent. And Dr. Metz, thank you, and all the physicians for
Being mad as hell.
For being mad as hell, and for trying to get past just the Affordable Health Care Act to universal health care.
Thanks for letting us participate. I look forward to seeing Michael's play.
All righty.
Right on, and we'll be back next week, positively revolting as ever.
Every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Arresting Power, Resisting Police Violence in Portland, Oregon.